Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September 21st, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Lola Dean. Today's session number is DEL 2001-05, and it's titled Book Discussion, Stones from the River by Ursula Heggie, Part 5. Let's listen in.
Oh, no, we've always met here.
Oh!
We've always met here, too.
Well, I can play Dan. You know the story about, you know, a lot of us up here are Lutherans, you've noticed. About the Lutherans. How many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't think I
wanted to know that.
It was more. Well, with Lutherans, it only takes one to change the light bulb, but the other nine stand around and say how much we miss the old one. And those of you who are Lutherans, is that accurate? Right. I'm one of those kind of people, as you've probably surmised, that kind of tend to push borders a little bit. So I probably was the one changing the light bulb. Okay, well, here we are, our last day. And I hope somebody's read the last two pages, because that's the part we're going to need some help with. Because I read it, and I read it, and read it again last night. And I still don't quite figure that part out. But maybe we'll all have to do a round-robin letter to figure it out in the next 6 months or something. But let's start on page 2421. And, gee, the light in here isn't as good as it is in that other room, is it? Well, next time we'll just have to say, but we've always met in here. Okay. All right, starting on page 421, there's a few things that we can just kind of go through before we get to specific pages. But she gets the postcard from Conrad, and what does the postcard have on it? A cat. So she knows who it's from. Of course, I'm sure that they couldn't sign things. The fact that a postcard got through from Switzerland, I thought was rather...
Amazing.
Yeah, that was kind of reassuring that, you know, in times like that, that some of the things still function. You know, it's kind of nice. You never know in times of great crisis what's going to function and what isn't, and it's always the most surprising things that continue functioning.
I think knowing the Germans, probably everything that could was done perfectly. I have a friend, I have to tell this one little anecdote, and then I'll go on. I'm sorry I talk so much. But she worked, after the war, in the 60s, she was in Germany, and she was doing her 60s trip around the world. While she was there, in order to earn enough money to keep going, she worked in a German laundry, and while she's working, she's learning her German vocabulary. And she's checking out the laundry as it goes by with her left hand. And she suddenly realizes that the whole machine has stopped. And somebody's yelling, and so she looks up, and this guy's saying, nine, nine, nine. Yeah, yeah. She was doing it with her left hand instead of her right. I'm sure he said Dunkoff, too.
You mean there's one way to do things?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Well, I would want to know.
Speaking of things functioning, did anyone else think it was strange that during the war that the Nazis allowed the publication of these cheap novels? Because he kept getting new paperback.
Well, they burned everything that was good, so.
So the trash is all that left.
But I thought you said there were four kinds, and one of them was cowboy and Indian stories.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, maybe they did that to keep the economy of the publishing houses going. Just, you know, let them publish tripe.
I wonder who was writing the cowboy and Indian stories.
They probably were doing like they do in lots of other countries and pirating it. You know, you get one copy. We used to, when we were living in northern Pakistan, we used to see the same movies that you were seeing as first-run movies in the theaters. And what they would do is someone in the States would go in with a camera, a video camera, and videotape the movie. and then get that tape over into Pakistan, and they would pirate reproductions of these. And they were terrible reproductions, but we saw the movies, so I had seen all the current movies by the time I came home. It was really pretty wild.
In English?
Oh yeah, they were, you know, they'd come, somebody in the United States would send it to a cousin in Karachi. And that cousin in Karachi had this big studio where he would just pump out the videotapes. So, life goes on.
That happens here
at home, you know. Well, shh. Okay, and then we have Max. We have Max and Trudy. We're still on the, they're having their swimming session. And what happens there?
Fog moves in.
Fog moves in, and Max almost gets caught. And that caused a little problem that we saw surfacing over and over and over again in this next in these 100 pages, because Herr Immer, wasn't it Herr Immer, the younger Immer? Anton Immer, right. And she really had to do some fast talking, didn't she, to...
She's good at that.
Yeah.
I thought that was one of her poorest examples of fast thinking.
Oh, okay.
She came up with the right answer for once, didn't she?
She should have. Well, maybe she should have just told the truth and seen what they said. Yeah. And of course, she often wondered.
They never believed her.
That's it. They never would have believed her. So she probably could have gotten by with it.
Was it before? I can't remember if it was back in that, you know, the other chapter or this one where... When Ingrid has that first baby, you know, from the soldier that left, and they had to bring him home quick to marry her.
Yes.
Baby. And she
gave it a name.
Rita after the saint with the wet feet.
Yeah.
That was good, Ingrid.
Desperate situation.
Okay, on page 429, we have the Abramowitzes back again. And I think that this is a page where finally we have some real change in personality. Let's see, Edith, you have a book, and it's open. How about at the bottom of page 429, where it starts after the break? And if you'd read two in St. Martin's Church on the next page.
Starting with one night in June of 1944, Abramowitz died in his sleep. The week after his funeral, his wife was arrested when, in one unforeseen and magnificent act of rage, she demolished the office of the Hitlerjugend in Frau Simon's former hat shop. The two uniformed youth leaders who watched the slender old woman enter with her cane were too stunned to move when she swung the cane around, scattering papers and files, smashing lamps and the pyramid-shaped mirror, which at the instant of splintering yielded to her images of everything that had ever happened in her marriage. Her cane ripped through the membership names with their tiny maps, with their tiny pinned flags that covered the walls, knocked down framed photos of children singing around bonfires and marching in parades. Trying to dodge her cane, the youth leaders wrestled her through the floor and tied her wrists, but not before she'd broken one pair of eyeglasses and left welts on their necks and faces. In the days after Frau Abramowitz was sent away, the old women in town would tell each other stories of amazing strength that sometimes becomes available to women for brief periods of time. They would recall a mother who lifted a farm tractor from the chest of her trapped daughter, a wife who carried her wounded husband twice her weight, 2 kilometers to the doctor.
Thank you. How do you think Frau Abramowitz is going to be remembered?
Not as that timid little person who denied and said, you know, let's just wait and be nice and polite and it'll all go away.
She finally stopped adapting, didn't she? It was a magnificent, they said a magnificent act. I just want to go right on.
Yeah.
finally, she kind of came through. Okay, then we have the next kind of important thing that I noted, in, or at least in my estimation, was on page 440, we talked just a little bit yesterday about Dresden, but Max was asked by Leo and by Trudy to take the Abramowitz's valuables, and the list was quite impressive. There was some very nice jewelry, as well as the sterling candlesticks, and the, I think, was there a menorah? I can't remember. And several other things that had great value. And you think of that house, which must have had, to me, so sad, beautiful books in it that probably were totally destroyed. But anyway, Max is asked to take these things to their daughter in Dresden, which is where they last knew she was. And on page 440, actually on page 441, we have the description of what happened in Dresden, and I thought it was just important that we read that. Let's see. Barbara, could you read at the beginning of the page those first two paragraphs?
441.
She felt stunned by the magnitude of the destruction. Thousands and thousands of people had perished in Dresden that February Tuesday, many of them refugees who couldn't be accounted for. Canisters of phosphorus had been dropped on the city, turning people into live torches, driving hordes of burning, shrieking bodies toward the ponds that had been established for extinguishing fires and now became graves as many drowned, trampled or crowded by others into deeper water. And then the bombs began to rain on the city for 40 minutes everywhere, without selection, on churches and hospitals and prisons and schools, killing, maiming, a carpet of bombs. With each horrible detail she'd find out, Trudy would despair more, and yet she'd try to picture Max alive, wounded and unable to let her know what had happened to him, but alive. She'd be patient, she'd wait, for as long as it would take. Nights, her fears presented her with every possible disaster that could have happened to him, and the worst was that he'd become one of the burned bodies buried in the mass graves that had been dug in an immense ditch around the center of Dresden.
Thank you. There's some things in these 100 pages that are hard for us as Americans to read, and we found the same thing in Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver, and I don't know how many of you have read that book. I read the book, and I didn't see it as a political novel at all. And I was talking with a friend whom I really love. We both share a love of travel. And she said, "Oh, Lola, how could you read that book? It was so anti-American." And I said, "But Joe, it was anti-evangelistic. I said, it tells the truth. And I guess in these 100 pages, I just want us to be open to the fact that there are many truths, and we sometimes know them and we sometimes don't. And I think that this is perhaps one of the truths that a lot of us did not know.
Didn't you think that book was one of the most clever?
Poisonwood Bible.
I loved the way it was written, and that whole, backwards, forwards.
If any of you haven't read that book, it's a treat. It's called Poisonwood Bible. And just to diverge for just a moment, it's the story of a Baptist, Southern Baptist minister who's really not given a call, but decides he has a call to go to Africa with his four wife and four daughters in the 50s.
Angola.
And it is a trip because it's told from the girls and in the 50s and then the girls in the 80s. So you go back and forth between this time. And the father is something else. Everybody in the book is something else. But it's quite an interesting book about religion, for one thing, but also about politics, for another. So you might enjoy it sometime.
Makes you afraid of snakes with little blue mouths.
Well, you need to be afraid of snakes with little blue mouths. They're called mambas, and they're horrible.
I thought it was the Congo, though. I didn't think it was Angola.
I think it wasn't it Lumumba that was killed?
Yeah.
Wasn't Lumumba that's killed in that?
Patrice Lumumba.
Yeah.
It wasn't the Congo?
Congo.
Was
okay.
The Congo.
I said, well, yeah, well, it's one of those countries.
Yeah, it was. He was there at the time that Patrice Lumumba was assassinated,
right,
and was encouraged to return to America, but opted not to.
Yeah.
The father.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's full of some really interesting people. It's another one of those books, so if you read it, it's good to write their names down.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you get really messed up.
Sorry.
That's okay. That's just another good book for you to think about. Back to Trudy. Okay. On page 443, we have the Americans arriving. Let's see, Sandy, would you, or Pat, would you like to read that about, it says, not too long ago, that paragraph.
Not too long ago, Trudy would have welcomed the Americans as rescuers, but since the firebombing of Dresden, that had changed. Besides, her aunt had warned her in a letter that a lot of Americans thought all Germans were Nazis. Trudy already knew what it was like to be considered an enemy within your own country because you were against the Nazis. And now she felt even more isolated because she might well be regarded an enemy by both sides.
And we're going to see a lot more of this in the next few pages to come.
Mm-hmm.
We have more deaths. Fraulein Bernstein commits suicide. And that brings us up to the years of 45, 46. So Trudy is now 29, 30 in that age time. The soldiers return, and there are three suicides within the first month of their return. These are the German soldiers coming back home. And on page 451, we have a little piece about the prisoners of war, the German soldiers coming back. Let's see, Geneva, I thought Lorraine wasn't coming. Lorraine is here.
Yeah.
Good. Would you read as the prisoners of war?
As the prisoners of war drifted back into town, you could tell by their appearance where they'd been held. They came from Russia prison camps. They were in rags and wore shoes stitched from wood and scraps of leather and fabric. While soldiers released from England had new uniforms, the rich brown of a Sunday roast, and proper fitting shoes made of leather, those from Russia carried the shadow of famine beneath their eyes, while those from England looked well fed. Those from Russia were timid, while those from England dared to talk of the future.
Thank you. Another little part of the history. We also find out at this time, during this time period, that Eva's parents did make it to Sweden. Was it Sweden?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I wrote down Sweden. I got the thinking. And George Weiler comes back from a Russian camp. And on page 452, we have Trudy's feelings about this. We're going to do quite a bit of reading today because there's a number of things that kind of tie us together. So let's see, starting on 452, the second main paragraph. Let's see, Jean, could you start reading that, and then when you get tired, just let us know and somebody else pick it up, because we're going to go for a couple pages here.
At times it felt suffocating to Trudy to have the four from the barn back in town. The war hadn't claimed a single one of them, though Hans Jürgen had been presumed missing in Russia, and Fritz Hansen was almost like a dead man without his jaw. Despite five surgeries, Fritz still looked hideous. His parents had reopened the bakery with the help of Alfred Meyer, who drove the bakery truck, but their own son worked only in the cellar where the bread ovens were. Though Fritz wanted to wait on customers, his parents figured people wouldn't buy from them if they had to look at their son's mangled face in the gauze, which, regardless how often Fritz replaced it, looked soggy and quivered with each breath like a small white animal that sucked itself to his throat. Paul Weinhardt had escaped miraculously when American tanks had advanced towards the trenches that he and nearly 200 German soldiers had dug. Rain-drenched ditches in which the men had squatted dozing off from fatigue and hunger. Only Paul and four others managed to scramble up into the trees and hide before the tanks pounded across the muddy ground and buried the Germans alive. And it was not an accident, because Paul watched as the tanks backed up and beneath their heavy tracks crushed all life below. Hans-Jürgen Braunmeier had surfaced in an American prison camp. When his mother came to the grocery store, she told Frau Weiler that some of the Americans had taunted prisoners by withholding water, even though the barracks were on a hill next to a clear brook. One 21-year-old from Bavaria, crazed with thirst, had crawled under the wired fence and rolled himself down the slope toward the brook. As he immersed his face in the stream, he was shot. Her son, Frau Baumeier said, was certain that, even though there had been enough food in the camp, the Americans had kept their prisoners close to starvation with only two bowls of soup per day. Their idea of punishment, Hans-Jürgen told his parents, they said it was only fair because the Jews got even less food in the KZs. Someone else?
Comments like that evoked indignation throughout town. Hadn't they all been deprived of housing and food? They too had lost husbands and sons, not to the KZ, granted, but to the war and to prison. And for them, it hadn't stopped with the end of the war. At least the Jews had been released from the KZs. In the American camp where her son had stayed, so Frau Braunmeier reported to the taxidermist, prisoners had been forced into hard labor, restoring demolished streets. Every day, two or more of the underfed prisoners had collapsed. Quite a few died. For a while, her son was allowed to work in the camp kitchen. But after he was caught eating potato peels from the trash heap, he was assigned to the latrine crew. The Amos acted like each one of our men was Hitler, Frau Braunmeier whispered to the priest's housekeeper. My son says it brought out the worst in them, and to think they believe they're better than the Germans.
Okay, could somebody read one more paragraph?
Both stories made the people of Burgdorf wary of the American soldiers who lived in their midst, those men who were kind to them on occasion, who let the small children ride on their shoulders. It was evident that the Amis were much tougher with the men, interrogating them and demanding proof that they had not participated in what the Amis called war crimes.
I would have done that too. So we have a picture here that isn't quite the picture that we have all kind of envisioned of the American troops coming in and saving everyone. There were problems that did exist. We have kind of, as typical Ursula Hege, she gives us this kind of grim picture. And then we get kind of a funny picture next, because here we've got the priest back again. And, now how is he going to manage this? Starting there on page 453, let's have a little happier kind of reading. Julian, do you have that? It's the very next paragraph.
Even men who had not fought the question, including Herr Pastor Beyer, who was exhausted from trading absolution for dreadful war confessions, irate at being summoned to the Rathaus, though it was only across the street from the rectory where his housekeeper was complicating his life enough with glances that made him feel he'd failed her in some significant way. He had to wait nearly an hour before a young American officer whose knees quite likely had never pressed the hard wood of a church pew inquired what the priest's position had been during the war. I live for my parish, hands folded on his raised belly. Herr Pastor Beyer recited the statement that he worked out more carefully than any sermon. He had written it in the morning after the Americans had come to Burgdorf. He had since revised it daily. As he told the Army officer about everything he'd done for his parishioners, his voice shook with conviction as it would in his very best sermons. I know you people are attacking us because we stayed silent. What good would it have done? Look at all the priests who were tried. He paused dramatically. They were arrested, killed at KZs. I chose to be silent because I knew I'd be a greater help to my parents if I could stay here.
Please read the next one, too, because it's kind of the...
Well, the pastor worried that his reputation might have been sullied by the questioning. He consoled himself after dark by spending three Gretchen with labor force and starting in on the Graupensuppe, barley soup, that Fräulein Teschner had cooked for the following day. As he ate, he imagined the car the bishop would surely provide for him now the war was over. A car. The priest thought as he finished the rabbit stew and opened the last garbage can of cherries, a nice car with blue upholstery if he were given the choice.
Thank you.
Back a little ways, wasn't it? Yota gave him just a run for his money, too, when Uncle Alexander had come back. He joined the army because he could not get over the loss of Eva. He came back AWOL and committed suicide. Mm-hmm. And then the priest wasn't going to bury him in the church lot because he was but she fooled him.
Yeah, I think Yota had something on him, didn't she, as I remember. She...
Well, she said that she'd never come back to church or anybody else she knew.
Yeah, she was going to tell some story.
He didn't dare lose the money. And the,
what is the word? She sort of blackmailed him, as I remember.
She had a lot of income. She had money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And what did he get instead of a car?
Scooter.
Can't you see him on this motorbike? Isn't that a visual picture? I mean, we just could just... That was just there. Right.
Kept calling
off the
two, which is a...
Yeah, trying to learn how to write it. I wrote down discussion between priest and sister Agatha. Let's see, I have 473 written down. Is that...
Oh, when she what was asked that? What she had done while the German soldiers were there to ease their...
She was on a big guilt trip, wasn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah.
Because she felt that she had... helped the Germans out because she was trying to heal them and make them comfortable. And
yeah, and how did that
play out?
Maybe we'll come across it. I can't remember exactly why I wrote that down. Sorry.
Well, she thought she turned over the Jews to the Germans, even though she came in, she treated them.
Yeah.
But she felt she should have told them to run. Got them out of there, not just facilitated their recovery so they could be transported to the death camps.
And what did the priest tell her? Do you remember? It seems to me there was something significant about that. Hopefully we'll come across it, because for some reason I must have thought that was important.
Does that have to do with the baby?
I honestly can't remember.
I can't find it anymore.
I must have written that late at night. Sorry about that.
Page 469, I see something about it. See, 469.
At the bottom.
Yeah, but now the sister has become hesitant. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes,
oh, yeah,
okay. Okay. You did the best you could, the best for myself, don't you see? Oh, right, because she really was trying to work through this guilt that she felt. And she says, I handed the prisoners over to the Nazis, that terrible obedience. I wanted to make their last days here as comfortable as possible, as you said. And he says, don't say that. That would make us all accomplices. But we are, don't you see?
But then that affected her in other ways, too, because she was going to be midwife to the dentist's wife.
Right, and then she sort of lost her ability to do anything. We get another glimpse of post-war Germany on page 456, right after the break. That first paragraph gives us a very good description of... what it must have been like. Let's see, John, you haven't read yet.
That first year after the war was the hardest for the people of Burgdorf. There was little food or coal. Some people froze. Milk still had a bluish sheen and was thinned down so much you could look through it. If you could no longer pay your debts, the bailiff would enter your home to paste the cuckoo, a sticker indicating a lien on the back of your furniture. You'd still have some time to pay your debts, but if you couldn't, the entire neighborhood would watch as your piano, say, or your chest of drawers was carried from your house. The shame of it. Mm-hmm. Though nearly everyone was struggling, it hurt your pride if your family went hungry. In the face of such poverty, it became even more important to keep things clean. Poverty like that made you think of the unknown benefactor whose memory caused you, at your poorest effort, to take up the habit of leaving anonymous gifts on the front steps of those who were more in need than you.
So you never know when your influence is going to go on, do you? Yeah, yeah. On page 459, I have another thing about the Americans. At the bottom of 459.
Oh, the teachers.
The teachers, yeah. And we've got so many teachers in this group. Let's see, Mary Ellen, why don't you go ahead and start
that?
Not
a teacher,
but... Well, the teachers can...
As the Americans carried on their investigations, teachers who had been members of the apartheid lost their jobs. There were trials, convictions. Some were prosecuted unjustly. Others went free even though they were guilty. Several teachers who feared upcoming interrogations fled overnight with their families, abandoning their homes. One threw himself in front of a train. Others swore they'd only joined the apartheid out of fear for their lives or because they'd been forced to in order to enter their profession or be promoted. Their behavior during the war years had been exemplary, they insisted. Once they'd been in the apartheid, of course, they'd been afraid not to comply because they would have been sent to the KC. One?
Yes, please.
Undercover freedom fighters, Kara Blockers, American, would say to her after another day of questioning. And he'd take her down to the cellar where he'd thrust her in onto the blankets he'd spread across the cement floor by the potato bin. Did you know my German Fräulein? His narrow face would move above hers, his hair much lighter than his eyebrows. That your entire country was filled with undercover freedom fighters? Not only the teachers were investigated. People all over town were afraid of being turned into the Americans by their neighbors or children, or of hearing knocks at their doors and being picked up, of not finding work or losing jobs they had. It struck Trudy as an ironic and just parallel to what the Jews had suffered for so many years, and she didn't feel any sympathy when people like Frau Heidenreich and her friends elaborated on their own suffering. Hadn't they become the real victims? Hadn't they endured separation within their families? Panic when the bombs had fallen? Many of them lamented the years without their children. While the Jews were treated like royalty, ordinary people like them were still persecuted, questioned about their political beliefs, although they had no idea what had really been going on in the KZs till after the war, and then they'd been shocked, no, horrified. It became a scramble to get letters of recommendation from those who had not joined the apartheid, people who had resisted the Nazis, though at that time it had seemed to everyone else like foolishness. But now it was good to know people like that, better yet if they owed you a favor.
Thank you. Okay, so here we have this, I think we've talked about this before, people not really believing what happened, and this feeling of, you know, everything had been taken away from them now. And they were having to give up their not only their belongings, but food was not available. And then being called traitors in addition to that. Again, we've got this loss of the war problem, the same thing that we had after the First World War. So it really came home. Now, one person who did make it through, one teacher who did make it through that time was Herr Stasek. And do you remember why? He paid his party dues. His wife paid the party dues, but Niemeyer never turned him in.
He absconded with the funds.
And he never put them on the list. So he was able to say he had not belonged. And so he was reinstated as a teacher. We also had another interesting thing happen here, which happens after every war, and also happened when the New York lost its power for 24 hours. 9 months later, you have a huge crop of babies. And on the bottom of page 470, there's just one of those funny little paragraphs that she inserts from time to time. And the other thing that Ursula Hagee seems to do is she presents us this broad political, economic picture of what's happening with the country, and then she brings us back to the humans again. And so this next little part, we're going to be talking about the humans, the neighbors, and what's happening. So let's read this, because it's just kind of fun. Let's see, Pat, why don't you go ahead?
The pastor had never held that many christenings in such a short time. There was the Malta girl, Hannah, George Wheeler's son, Manfred, old Anton Immer's granddaughter, Sybil, the children of the two widows, a son, Heinz, for the judge's widow, a second daughter, Karen, for Ingrid Hebel, and then, of course, Clara Bacher's illegitimate son, Rolf. The Klein family moved with a daughter, the Muller family with a son, and two other unmarried women with children whose fathers were American soldiers.
That also happens. We lived in a town on the coast during the Second World War, and I don't know where you folks lived during the Second World War, but for those of us on the Pacific coast, the war in Japan was the war. The Eastern War, the war in Europe, really didn't exist in our minds. We knew that we were going to be invaded from that ocean that was only 11 miles away. And so all of our orientation was towards that. But our funny little town of about 250 Finns was occupied by the army for about 2 months. And we had to show our driver's licenses before we could go across the bridge to the store where we went, you know, every day. It was really pretty interesting. But 9 months later, Maisel had a new crop of babies. It was really pretty interesting.
Maisel, what's your maiden name?
Hill.
Well, Judy, that lives next door to us, is from Maisel.
Oh, really?
Her father was the head of the ice cream milk dairy.
Dairy Gold? Well, we'll talk.
Yes.
I don't know what her maiden name was.
Right. Well, I might even know her married.
Well, I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
She went to high school with Maisel.
Oh, yes.
She grew up in, Gray's?
Gray's River. Oh, she was a Gray's River girl.
Yeah.
I understand small towns. Very well. I was lucky. I was the third generation, so I was okay.
During World War II, this is getting off the subject just a little bit, but we used to go out to Boys Club and Girls Club camp during the 40s. And in about 1944, they had brought in a very large contingent of the Desert Corps, Rommel's troops, and they were stationed around our towns. And they lived out there, and they were cutting pulp for the paper mills. And we were out playing games in the woods, and we ran right into these guys. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them spoke English. In fact, some of them had relatives in central Wisconsin.
Oh, really?
They were allowed to go into town on certain evenings, maybe once or twice a month.
Did they have people who went with them?
I presume they did. They had some money that they were given, and they'd go into the taverns and sit down and have some drinks with the people, speak German to some of the people that spoke German, which is quite interesting as I look back on it.
Yeah. And did people didn't resent them?
I don't think so.
In Dale's hometown, there was a German prisoner of war camp outside of town. And
there was an Italian one down in Georgia or someplace like that.
But they would come in and work at the, it was a creamery egg drying plant that his dad managed, and they'd say, there are more eggs here than in all of Germany. And then they came back for this, and they enjoyed themselves, so they came back for this big reunion, like 50
Really?
Years.
Yeah.
the ones that were still
there. Yeah, Jean, you had your...
prisoners of war that were working in the farm fields that the state owned around Waupun.
Oh, really?
Wisconsin.
You're from Wisconsin, too.
And, we couldn't go out of the house, and we'd have to get a ride to school, and people were really panicky about it.
Really? Yeah.
Well, these guys gave us candy out there. Gum.
They were probably better fed than anybody in Germany at that point.
Oh, I'm sure they were.
Yeah. Julian, you had a point.
Has anybody read Gulag Archipelago?
Yes.
And there you said the Russian philosophy was, it was a shame to be captured alive as a prisoner of war. Mm-hmm. When they were repatriated, they were immediately killed.
Really? I've forgotten that.
As traitors.
Wow. Especially the Ukrainians.
Yeah, they liked to kill them.
Mm-hmm. We were invited to a picnic when we were visiting some friends of Roger's in southern Germany back in the 80s, and they were getting together with some friends out in the country. And we were the only Americans there, couldn't understand most of what was going on. But when some of them found out that we were Americans, they wanted to come and practice their English on us because they had been prisoners of war in one of them in a camp in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
And was he the one that moved to Pennsylvania afterwards? Or somebody had been in Pennsylvania too, and then there was one that had been in England.
There was a woman who got married to a soldier. Lived in Pennsylvania.
Well, she was the daughter of the man who'd been in Georgia.
And he was so rich until she got over to the States and found out that he really didn't have any money.
Oh. He
was very poor and...
One of those war bride stories.
but the stories that he wanted to tell us about Georgia were good.
Uh-huh.
He had good memories of being there.
Well, I'm glad we treated him well.
Someplace, yeah.
Yeah. The Japanese who were in the internment camps didn't feel quite that same way. I've known quite a few of them. I've also known a number of people who were at Dachau and Buchenwald, and I'm sure some of you do too. A lot of them settled on the island that we, the other island we used to live on. And it's only now, 50 years later, that their stories are really coming out. And one of the women, who is a very fine artist, the only way she can express it is through her paintings. But she was a beautiful woman. She was a teenager during those years. So my suspicion is she was handled very poorly. There's one comment on page 473, which I think is it goes along with that same kind of thing that we've been harassed, everything's been taken away from us. I mean, 473, yeah, it's almost down to the bottom. That some people still claim they couldn't comprehend how the KZs could have happened, never clear to Trudy how many had known and how many had been afraid to believe the horrors. Until my death, I won't be able to understand that. We weren't told what was going on. If I'd known, I wouldn't have wanted to continue living. Someone told me in 44, and I didn't believe it, but then I later found out it was the truth. And here's the one I really love. Don't forget, Hitler was an Austrian, not a German. I guess Okay, years between 46 and 49, Bergdorf is back to quote-unquote normal. We have baby Hanna, who is Jutta's daughter? Whose daughter is she? Jutta's daughter, Jutta and Klaus's daughter. And we have this rather complicated relationship that starts between this darling baby and Trudy. And it's very complex, and it gets more and more complex. She loves this child just so much, and she doesn't know quite how to handle it. I mean, she offers to take the baby so Jutta can paint, which is a very generous thing, except that she really wants this baby to be her baby. And her father warns her, and several other people say, you know, this is getting beyond the point of normal. Jutta paints Trudy, and I think this description of the painting is so wonderful. Betsy, would you read that? It's at the very bottom of page 477, and it's the next to the last line. It says, once she'd painted her.
Once she'd painted her, but she hadn't shown Trudy the canvas because she was afraid to offend her. In the painting, part of the town showed through the gap between Trudy's O-shaped legs, while the rest of Bergdorf fit into her whole, her wide body.
Thank you. Do you get a visual image of that? Trudy had all the secrets. She had all the knowledge, either between her legs as it was standing there or in her. She was the personification of that town. Okay, and then she did, Hannah did a painting of, and offered a painting to Trudy. And she had, apparently her paintings were quite modern, what we would call, well, we ought to ask, what's his name, who just came from St. Olaf, what kind of paintings they were. But they sounded quite modernistic to me, with vibrant, vibrant colors. And Trudy really didn't apparently like the paintings too much, so she chose the one that she had done of Hannah, of the baby. And you have to let her have it, and she took it home, and she put it up with in the room with her pictures that she had left from Max, who of course has not shown up yet and will never return. So that was her loss there, but she has this painting of the baby. And then we have Matthias coming back. And again, we've got the otherness, which we've been reading about throughout. Let's see, you haven't read yet, Ruth, have you?
No.
Okay. On page 482, Matthias, I just set the scene just a little bit. Matthias is having a problem. He doesn't really know what he wants to do. He's in the seminary, but he hasn't yet taken his vows. And starting right at the top of that page there, Ruth, if you'd start with, why don't you start at the top? I can't remember what the question was he says
and,
no
yeah,
to.
And why not? Because I've tried for other things. Because I've tried for other things before, nothing that bad. Only shoving around, taunting. Our superiors don't take it that seriously. They have me figured as different anyhow. Our country has a history of that, justifying attacks on those who are different, erasing them. You're making this into something bigger than it is. It's much bigger than anything I could make it, believe me, Matthias. Don't you see? This war is still going on, and will be going on, until we all accept everything that has happened. We won't have that peace people believe we already have. He was silent for a long time, and finally he looked into her face. What do you do if you're called to the wrong thing? She was terribly afraid of saying words that would make him feel even worse. It was obvious to her that he was not talking about the church, but about battling that within him that called him to seek out his own gender. She wanted to lay her hand on his arm, yet he looked so brittle as he stood before her that she was certain he'd splinter if she touched him. It must be awful, she said carefully, to be called to something one does not want. And what does one do with that? His voice was raw, mocking. I don't know. Unless what? Unless there's some way one can learn to want what is called for.
That's, thank you. Mm-hmm. Unless there is some way one can learn to want what one is called for. That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Accept yourself. Mm-hmm.
There's the Holden prayer, which was read the other night, has the saying in it, give me the courage to go out to roads unyet untrodden, the ending of which I cannot see, to what we are called. It's really easy to do what we're called to if we like it. but to be called to something that's different. And obviously, Matthias is dealing with his homosexuality. And she encourages him to leave the seminary and to go back to his music. But he says no, he won't do that. He will go back to the seminary where at least he's safe from himself.
But not from his fellow seminarians.
Yeah. No, and they certainly weren't very nice, were they? In the period before that, what he was telling her about was they had given him castor oil, I believe, wasn't it? And then tied him to a tree, and it was pretty grim. I thought seminarians were nice. On the next page, whoops, I keep losing my... I miss our tables.
Yes.
On the next page, there's one more little thing that I just marked, and Matthias says, "What if that calling is a sin?" And Trudy shook her head slowly. "My father, he has a theory about sin. I'm sure the pastor wouldn't agree with him, but my father says much of what the church calls sin is simply being human."
Isn't that the second time we've heard her say that?
It could be.
Yeah, he mentioned that in the beginning.
He was saying something like that.
Yeah, earlier on.
The second line from there is really significant. He says being kind is the most important thing of all.
That was in that place.
It was. This is the
faith, hope, and love, these three, but the most important of these is love.
Yes.
Well, then we have another very human part with Ingrid. Rather painful part. Anne, you haven't read yet. Would you read at the bottom, top of page 484, those first two paragraphs?
"One morning in April of 1947, Ingrid Hebel tried to save her children by giving them the greatest gift she could fathom, an eternity in heaven. Nights when she had knelt by their beds in prayer, God had reminded her that no one but she loved her children enough to do this for them. It would be their one chance at redemption. If they continued living, they would reach the age of reason and succumb to sin as she had. Now they were both still pure, although she'd seen their greed, even in the eyes of her younger daughter when she nursed her. Though the age of reason was 7 years of age, Ingrid didn't dare wait that long. She had to assure her children's safe passage into eternity. And fortunately, God was calling her while they were still pure. Once she decided to obey, the turmoil that had been hers for as long as she could remember fell off her. She felt tranquil, almost holy. The one thing that saddened her was that she would not be with her children. But since she was tainted already, leaving her life behind would be a mortal sin. No, her own redemption would come from relinquishing her daughters to heaven and then waiting until God called her to join them."
Thank you. So she does, she throws both children over, well, she throws one over, who is killed. And then she dies within a few days herself. And then the younger daughter, Karen, lives on. And do you remember Ingrid was the one who wanted to be the missionary?
Mm-hmm.
And her home was the one where Trudy always felt uncomfortable, that something had happened, but Ingrid could never tell her. But at the top of page 487, we have the answer to this question.
Yeah.
Marianne, you haven't read that, have you? Would you read that paragraph, "And yet"?
"And yet Holger and Erna Braun, along with the town, would keep waiting for Ingrid's flaw to manifest itself within Karen, an expectation they would see confirmed. When at 13, the girl would swell with her grandfather's sin as though her drowned sister had found a way to return to her family through Karen's womb and claim her right to grow up after all."
Isn't that tragic?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Does war do this
to people, or does this happen anyway?
No.
It happened before there was any war there.
Yeah. It happens more than one.
That's exactly it. More than any of us care to know, I think is a good way to put it. Well, 1948 has come along. Some good or bad things, depending on how you see it, happen to the town. It gets cleaned up. They start painting the houses. And what comes in?
French fries.
Jewish people, right.
What did you say?
French fries.
French fries.
The French fries come in. Oh. And also an ice cream parlor.
Ice cream.
I missed that.
Oh, I never miss an ice cream parlor. But on page 488, we have this same theme presenting itself again. About two-thirds of the way down the page. Who has not read yet? Geneva, you haven't read yet. Would you like to start? She knew the brokenness.
She knew the brokenness would manifest itself again, as it had in Ingrid and the judge and Fritz Hansen and new countless others, and it didn't take long. That November, Hans Ruben Brommeyer killed his fiancée. He found her half naked in the car of a man who had asked her to dance the previous Saturday, where she would, where she and Hans Jurgen had been celebrating his 33rd birthday. Without glancing at Hans Jurgen, she stood up and followed the man to the dance floor. For 5 days and five nights, Hans Jurgen stalked his fiancée and the man that had acted out every last one of his jealous fantasies as if they were the ones who put him up to their fornication. After he shot both of them, he went home to the farm and sat at the kitchen table, quiet and immensely tired, put the gun on the tablecloth between his limp hands. His parents called the police, and his trial drew more people than Easter Mass. Lined up on the steps of the courthouse, they waited for the chance of a seat inside, where the judge listened to testimonies of Hans Jurgen's classmates, neighbors, and an amazing number of people who had in some way come into the path of his rage.
So he came full circle, didn't he? Yeah, poor Hans Jurgen. On 499, I've marked, this is when she's going through some trials with Hannah. And Hannah's parents have decided, first of all, they got a babysitter for her, and have taken her sort of away from Trudy. And Trudy is dealing with this, and she has this rather strong feeling on this day. It's a rainy, rainy day, and she tells Jutta when she's coming to pick up Hannah, she says, "I'm not feeling well, better not bring her over for a while." And she says, "Has Hannah done anything to upset you?" And she says, "Of course not." And then she closes the library and she goes out. And this is a description of this confusion that she's feeling over this child. Let's see, Pat, you've got it. Go ahead. But she was already out in the rain.
Instantly, her hair and clothes were wet. She had no idea where she wanted to go, only that she had to get away from the place where she'd come up against her own brokenness. She should have seen that brokenness when she cloaked her love for Hannah with silence. There was an edge of craziness to her love, that same edge of craziness she'd seen in Ingrid when she'd spoken about God, in her own mother when it came to her escapes, in the face of Herr Heinrich when he used to praise his Führer. And as with all of them, that edge of craziness also presented to a haven where they belonged or felt peace, as she did with this love for Hannah.
Go ahead.
With Hannah, she was at her best, at her worst, and she had to stop. Keep going.
Yes, if you would, through that paragraph.
Ahead of her, the earth rose, and she recognized the long, even curve of the dike. She nearly slipped as she climbed up, and when she stood at the top, she couldn't see the river, only the rain that slanted in a gray sheet. But she thought she could smell the river, the way she'd smelled it in her mother's hair after she'd come home from one of her flights. As she made her way down the other side of the dike, she could almost feel the loss of Hannah, then the loss of Max and her mother and Ingrid and Frau Simon. For an instant there in the meadows, she thought she could see the man who touches his heart, but it was only a stunted tree. It struck her that her life was filled with ghosts. Some days she thought more often of the dead than the living. She saw Frau Abramowitz standing by her window in the dark, saw the outline of her body as the sky grew lighter around her, forcing itself into a halo that enveloped her. She saw Gretchen Bromberg inside the grocery store, Eva on her wedding day, both surrounded by ruins, by rims of light, and she felt terrified of all the losses that lay ahead of her, especially the loss of her father.
Thank you. And of course then we do have the death of Leo Montag, which was a sad day for Bergdorf, and his funeral was the biggest that anybody could ever remember. And the grief that is felt by everyone at that time. We also have a wonderful description on page 500, which we're going to skip, 500 and 501, but I just pointed out to you, you might want to read that about the river and the water and the stones again. It's a metaphor for the life that is happening and has happened in her life. And the reason I'm skipping is because I know we're getting close to 4 o'clock and some of you are going to go up to the front. On page 504, we have Trudy back to her stories. Let's see. Gwen, you haven't read for a little while. Why don't you start now the purpose of her stories at the bottom of the page there, then up to the top of the next.
Where are we at?
504.
Okay. Trudy noticed that Frau Turgen liked to check out new books.
Oh, now at the bottom, I'm sorry. Now the purpose of her stories.
Now the purpose, okay. Mm-hmm. Now the purpose of her stories had changed. She spun them to discover their meaning. In the telling, she found, you reached a point where you could not go back, where, as the story changed, it transformed you too. What mattered was to let each story flow through you. It was becoming impossible to revert to her old reasons for telling stories, to get even, to prod, or soothe. But most people didn't know that. They were still afraid of her. They didn't understand that now she told a story for the sake of the story, taking pleasure in how each formed within her. It could still begin by feeling drawn to secrets, but she could curb the urge to tell, let it settle into something that nurtured the fragments of life which fell into her way until a story was ready to unveil itself.
So in the final finishing up of the book, essentially we've kind of dealt with everyone who was in the book from the beginning, except George. And I was hoping that some of you had a chance to read the last two pages. And well, I think maybe I haven't read much, so maybe I'll just read this to you. Because I find this a little confusing, and I guess maybe this is one of those things that kind of haunts you about a book, and you always kind of wonder about it, but maybe it was clearer to somebody. She's gone back out to the mill, and she's walking through this area, and she's talking about George the whole time. And at the bottom of page 524, she saw herself lifting her father's bamboo rake from the rack beneath the back of the pay library. And as she pulled the bamboo teeth through the earth, she kept stepping back, drawing the rake toward herself, knowing that gradually all of the soil would show the smooth rib pattern. But until then, as in her story for George, There were clumps left over, and she had to pull the rake through them again and again, distributing the earth while discarding debris. It was though every story she had ever told had brought her to this moment, to this story that would tell itself through her. It would be the best story she ever told, better even than the story she and Pia had woven between them that day at the circus. And she thought of all the people who had loved her stories, her father, Hannah, Max, Eva, Conrad, Robert, and earliest of all, her mother. She felt the strength of their arms as surely as if they were pulling the rake with her through the earth. The final design wouldn't happen all at once. There would be the rearrangement of it all. A fine combing through, there would be perseverance and a reverence for the task. There would be assurance that, indeed, a design would emerge. George's eyes were grave as he waited for her to continue her story. It was the brief span of evening when all things are etched lucidly into the sky, just before they yield their separateness and blur into the night. Trudy stretched herself. What she could offer George was far more than what had happened, a certain sequence that would lead him to the core of the story, a story that would hold an entire world. It had to do with what to tell first, though it hadn't happened first, and what to end the story with. It had to do with what to enhance and what to relinquish and what to embrace. The question I had in that part, was George really there? I read that last four pages over and over and over, and I never could quite resolve that.
It mentioned just before then that she remembered the frock and the, and she's, it's like she's dreaming.
Yeah. It's almost like
that was a memorable time of her life.
You wonder if George wasn't the first love in her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was her first friend, remember?
Yeah, and mm-hmm. that she never really gave it up, in spite of other relationships mm-hmm. they had with Matt and all that.
Yeah.
Really, George that she had desired all the years.
Trying to resolve that.
And George married, I can't remember.
Yes. No. Yes, he married. Uh huh.
Yeah,
George Wyler was one of those multiple babies that got converted. If anyone ever gets any more insight to that part, write me. Because I still am a little confused about it, but it's beautifully written, that last two paragraphs. And I don't know, maybe Ursula Hagee was tired of the book and just wanted to finish it. 500 pages is a lot to write. Okay.
Maybe that's what's going to be part of the first
one. Maybe that's part of the next one that she's going to take up. All right, I gave you two questions at the end of the day yesterday. What do you see as the themes of the book?
Love.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh. All kinds.
Mm-hmm. The challenges of being different.
Yes, the otherness, as they called it.
Otherness. Mm-hmm. But then, in reading that, I thought about Mary Jo Clark, how she felt she was different, or the one who was talking about Mary Jo Clark, she thought she was different too. Mm-hmm. So don't we all, whether we're fat or skinny or what, handicapped, don't we think that somebody else always has it better than we do?
Don't we all have a little bit of otherness of some kind?
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Guilt? Yes, the guilt that is so demeaning to a society and to an individual mm-hmm. that they feel themselves totally unworthy of seeking to achieve any goals they ever had. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing seems to be we're just weighted down with everyone's guilt. The whole society is now guilty at the end of this, at the end of the book.
Do you think any of that translates to kind of where we are today and wondering how we resolve and deal with our own world at the moment? I'm not sure it's guilt, but there certainly is a brokenness which certainly came through this book a lot. We don't, how do we put it all back together?
You're talking about the United States?
Yeah, just our world right now.
The world right
now? Yeah, I think it's bigger than the United States.
Boy,
it is a brokenness.
Yeah, it is a brokenness, yeah. Julian.
I also see courage.
I see real courage in this book. The love and all of the things that happened to Trudy, all of the bad things happened to Trudy, helped her to be strong enough to be very courageous.
Mm-hmm. Julian, you were going to say something?
I was going to say, we don't, aside from Leo, and maybe one or two others, we don't see any deep spirituality. It's more of a reality, and it's sadly true of our own society, too. Mm-hmm. That most people don't really, aren't Bonhoeffers.
Yes. Yeah, we all would like to be, no, I don't know.
Maybe
think about that.
Leo had her as a child, well, you know, wasn't his really, but maybe having to raise her made him a more spiritual person too, you know.
I think she was Leo's child.
Yeah.
Oh, Dave? Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I do.
It says she was conceived on the Russian coat the day he came home early from the war.
Oh, I thought the mother had...
Well, she'd had her little affair, but I think it was long enough ahead of time that the 9 months were okay.
No, the affair was with Amy, wasn't it?
Yes.
A great benefactor.
Yes. And, you know, when he died, remember the father says, you know, Herr Hesping loved your mother a lot. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
I do.
So he knew. Okay, yes, go ahead, Sandy.
I was thinking as I read the last chapter that she was so good at describing all of the goodness and the imperfections of people. And she didn't have any really perfect person in the book except for Leo. Mm-hmm. But she gave him a stiff leg so he wasn't
perfect. It was very real that way, isn't it? There aren't any perfect people, even if they think they are.
But his relationships were closest to perfect than anyone else in the book.
Yeah.
Everyone had their faults, but you don't hear her, you don't read about her writing anything bad about her father.
Right.
She loved Frau Eberhard, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was...
But he didn't let his love affect his life with her in any way.
You mean Trudy,
well,
loved...
Trudy loved
Frau Eberhard.
Frau Eberhard, for the person she was, the mother of... We could help him too.
Who was your favorite character?
Her father.
Leo. I like Jutta.
You like Jutta?
I like Conrad.
Conrad?
Frau Bremowitz.
I like Trudy.
Frau Bremowitz, okay.
I do too. Frau Bremowitz.
I liked her at the end.
I think she had strengths that we didn't see, and she enlarged Trudy's world.
She was very real, wasn't she? Frau Bremowitz.
And she was in love with Leo all those years, too, and never ever said it.
I like Max. Max kind of gave a new dimension to Trudy.
Yes.
And she now knew a big secret that she wasn't going to share with the rest of the community.
She didn't either, did she?
No, she never did share it.
I think her father knew.
Yeah.
Any other favorite characters?
I also like Sister Adelheid.
Adelheid.
As long as you keep escaping, they never get you.
You know, like the poor old Hans Jürgen, you know, how many, like 20, every single thing he'd ever done in his life came out of his own. But they all remembered at his trial and brought every last little thing. Even Trudy thought she should probably win and give him a few details. And they put him in the asylum and he kept escaping too.
Yeah.
Knocked off a few people every time.
Have you ever known people like Hans Jürgen? I have. We had one or two.
And he couldn't, you know, he was abused at home too.
Yeah.
It's just the way of life.
Right. Those trials are quite interesting because when the nun testified, Matilda, she pointed at him and said, the murderer over there did the following things in school.
No biased opinion here. Okay, we're going to have to cut it off because you've got 5 minutes to go to the bathroom before you go up to the museum. But I would just like to tell you how much I have enjoyed doing this. This was the best one we've ever had. And it has been really fun. And I thank you all for participating so actively. So, and if you haven't finished it, go home and read it.